Hello, everyone, and welcome to our discussion today about hospitals can work to prevent violence in their communities. I'm Julia Resnick with the Association for Community Health Improvement and Health Research and Educational Trust. Both are affiliates of the American Hospital Association. This discussion is part of an AHA-wide initiative called Hospitals Against Violence. You can learn more about the work that we've done over the past year and our upcoming Hospitals Against Violence Day on June 9th at aha.org. The reason that we're all here today is because we want to learn from our colleagues at the University of Maryland Medical Center, and we are lucky to have a really great team with us today. I'd like you two to introduce yourselves so that our listeners can start recognizing your voices.
Hi, I'm Erin Walton. I'm the clinical supervisor for the Violence Prevention Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center in our Adams Cali Shock Trauma Center.
And I'm Ann Williams. I'm the Director of Community Health Improvement for University of Maryland Medical System.
Can you talk a bit about your community and how violence emerged as a health issue for your hospital?
The University of Maryland Medical Center really serves patients from a local, regional, and national area of origin. But for purposes of this discussion, we're really going to be talking about the West Baltimore community. And so specifically, to tell you a little bit about from a community benefit service area, we defined our West Baltimore community as seven specific zip codes that we serve, and these represent some of the most underserved, vulnerable individuals in the city and actually the state of Maryland as well. So hopefully that gives a little bit of a background of the general community. Now, from that, the way that we began to get involved in this issue is that, of course, after the Affordable Care Act, we did a CHNA, a Community Health Needs Assessment, in fiscal year 12 for the first time, and then again in fiscal year 15. But even in that first CHNA process, we were looking at prevalence data on various violence-related activities, everything from homicide rates as well as domestic violence rates. But even before that, 15 years ago, one of our physicians in the Shock Trauma Center, Dr. Carnell Cooper, really started the program, and it was based on his experience with one particular patient that had come in for a gunshot wound, was here for an extended period of time in shock trauma, and then he was discharged, but then very quickly returned. And Dr. Cooper was heard saying aloud in the operating room that we have to do something to stop this revolving door for these victims of violence. So from that standpoint, he really felt compelled to begin some of his initial research, and the violence intervention program really began in shock trauma. So as that program began and became more robust over the years, as I said, then you've kind of fast forward to our first CHNA process in fiscal year 12 and then in 15. We began to look at some of the data on a local level. We were just really shocked at some of the rates. I mean, we knew that violence was an issue in our city, but when you really look at some of the rates specifically in those zip codes in these West Baltimore communities, it was really astonishing. So I want to just give you a couple of these rates, and this was from our most recent community health needs assessment in fiscal year 15. So as a Baltimore City as a whole, the homicide rate at that point was 20.9, and that represents number of homicides per 10,000 population. But then in our Southwest Baltimore neighborhood, it was really more than double that. It was 44.2. per number of homicides per 10,000. And then in our Upton Druin Heights neighborhood, which really is right next door to Southwest Baltimore, was 37.9. So you can see both of those two neighborhoods of just of the seven had double the rates of homicide in those two neighborhoods. And then for domestic violence, it was really pretty much more of the same. The overall incidence of domestic violence in the city was 40.6, and that's measured a little bit differently. That's number of incidents per 1,000 population. And in the Southwest Baltimore neighborhood, it was 66.3, and then in Upton Druid Heights, it was 55. So you can see from both of those statistics that we were really dealing with a very large, high incidence rate of homicide and domestic violence that we really felt we needed to address. So that became a priority and has been on our priority and our radar as a strategic community need ever since fiscal year 12.
I know that the community violence comes up a lot in CHNAs. Sometimes hospitals decide that, you know, this is too challenging of an issue to address. What drove your hospital to get involved in violence prevention work?
Well, I think that we really felt like it was a pressing need for our community and was so interrelated with the growing need around behavioral health, substance abuse. I mean, so many things were kind of coming together, and there's so many social determinants in these neighborhoods that really were all so linked. Poverty, lower educational levels, just so many things, lack of really sustainable jobs, that we felt that, you know, we can't really address one without addressing the other. So it really made sense to begin, well, to continue our work with violence prevention. And I want to make a note, because we've had questions ever since the national attention on the Freddie Gray incident back in April of 2015. Many times we get the question, did we just get involved from fiscal year 15 on? And really, hopefully the listeners can see that we really have not. We've been involved in this work for 15 years. You know, we were saddened by the incident, but we're not deterred. We still continue to go in those neighborhoods, and you'll hear a little bit more about that from Erin.
Perfect. And I think it's a great transition to talk about the work that you're actually doing. So, Erin, can you tell us a bit about your violence prevention work?
Sure. So the violence prevention program has sort of two unique case management programs. The one, which was conceptualized by Dr. Cooper back when he was a trauma surgeon here, is the violence intervention program. And so this is an intense post-discharge case management model where we have case managers that meet the patients when they're here with their injury. We'll visit them at their bedside while they're in the hospital. And then once they're discharged, the case managers will follow up with them to engage them in the services that we offer. The services are really driven by an individual needs assessment that the case managers do with the patients in order to determine what their goals are at this stage in their lives and in their healing or recovery. Some start off with very simple, short timeline goals of getting back to work or moving out of the neighborhood where they were injured. Others have bigger, more long-term goals, returning to school to, you know, achieve a higher educational status, getting back involved in estranged family members' lives, or otherwise somehow rectifying issues that they may feel contributed to their injury. So that may be legal issues as well. Once the case managers complete sort of the individual assessment, we offer them individual counseling that I can provide as a social worker. We have a weekly peer support group that meets, and then the case managers talk to their clients anywhere from multiple times a day to maybe a couple times a month, depending where they are in the spectrum of recovery and what their needs are and how closely we're working with them. Again, it can range from, you know, providing applications or information and referral to accompanying a client to the Department of Social Services or accompanying them to court. Or having other sort of interdisciplinary meetings in order to help them achieve whatever they've identified. It's all very client-centered and client-driven. So we'll outreach patients that we don't get a chance to see while they're here, but we really leave the door open for them to engage in their own case management and what they want to get out of it. And then we have a case management program also for victims of domestic violence. And so it's a similar model where we have a program coordinator and two case managers that meet patients while they're here. Our domestic violence program is unique in that it's 24-hour-a-day coverage to the whole medical center. So at any point in anybody's shift, if they work here, they can pick up the phone and call a number that a real person answers on the other end and can consult or will come to the hospital to meet with the patient in order to either safety plan or, again, provide information or resources. And then we offer those patients case management as well. So those are sort of the two tiers of the violence prevention program that we do at the hospital-based level.
Can you talk a little bit about why the hospital is such a good setting for addressing violence?
There's a couple reasons. The main reason is that we can provide some level of safety while the patient is here admitted. We can't control all the factors in the neighborhoods around us that contribute to violence, but we really do our best to provide a safe area for them to disclose. First of all, that might be the first step to getting help, is disclosing what's going on, especially for our victims of domestic violence. But also the victims of street violence, you know, may have a certain lifestyle that they live up to expectations of in the neighborhood. And when those pressures are removed, they may find it easier to build rapport with our case managers, several of whom have lived experiences as victims of violence or losing family members to homicide. So we provide the safety for the patient to be honest about what they need. And then hear what we have to offer. And then we do have an astounding amount of resources that we can call upon in order to support the patients. And we've gotten grant funding at the state and federal level. We collaborate with task forces and committees, both at the hospital level and then at the community level. So we find friends in many places that we can call on to help our patients once they're outside of the sort of safety net that we provide here.
And I'm also curious, you know, as you're doing work like this, I'm sure you're learning from what you're doing and changing things. So how is your violence prevention work evolved over time?
We are constantly having to evolve to keep up with the patient's needs. We have older clients in our program who suffered one gunshot wound with maybe a low-powered handgun 20 years ago, and their trajectory has been very different than a 20-year-old who's a new paraplegic or a new quadriplegic and had, you know, maybe brain surgery or some other, you know, high level of intervention while they were here. So mm-hmm. those two clients have very different needs. And while we strive to evolve rapidly as the clients do, other systems that we work with, you know, Department of Social Services and things like that, I think really struggle to keep up with the growing need. So we've had to become more creative in where we seek funding and where we seek allies, and also to preserve and be good stewards of our own resources, not recreating any wheels, knowing what our partners in the community are doing that we can leverage or collaborate with them so that we're not, there's only two case managers in the violence intervention program. So the three of us between seeing patients and all the other things that we do can't do everything. And so we know that there's really good work going on in the community that we really want to build upon as well. We work closely with our victim compensation unit in the state's attorney's office. We talk to public defenders frequently. Community engagement initiative between our medical center and our University of Maryland Baltimore has been a really strong outlet for us to look for workforce development opportunities for our clients, but also for just like positive downtime activities in the community. So like Anne was saying earlier about the Spring Fest this weekend and the Community Engagement Center, those are things that are low risk, high reward for our patients to engage in. That's like a positive mm-hmm. sort of part of their neighborhood.
And I would just add another way that we've kind of further evolved and actually really moved more upstream with some of our activities is we've established a partnership with some local elementary schools. And these two elementary schools are right within these two of our hardest hit neighborhoods, the two zip codes I mentioned I spoke to a little bit ago. So Aaron's been doing some work and our teams have been doing some work kind of really proactively with those children, not just around kind of conflict resolution or communication skills, self-esteem, but then on a broader level, the organization has taken on some of these children's needs in terms of just very basic needs within the classroom and then personal needs within their local community, everything from expanding their food pantry to school supplies, et cetera. So we're hoping that also by moving upstream and trying to address some of the social determinants early on with some of these kids that hopefully we can, you know, prevent violence.
One elementary school that's just right in the neighborhood that we get a lot of our victims of violence from, so we're making the assumption that the children at the school are related to the people that we're treating in our violence intervention program. We offered to replicate our peer support group in that school for, we were thinking maybe like young teenage boys, and the school responded and said, we really need an intervention for our third grade girls, our 8 and 9 year old girls, who are just overexposed to trauma on so many levels, you know, domestic violence, survivors of homicide. And so rather than come directly at the issue, we developed this girls' lunch bunch where we used storytelling concepts with them to draw out themes in their lives of loss, but also hopefulness for the future and trying to inspire in them long-term planning, you know, matriculating into higher education, all of those good values that we want to see the young girls sort of striving for. So one of the things we learned is that they are very, you know, they get a lot of support in school, but then when they leave school, they are sort of witnesses to this street violence. And many of them know where our hospital is because they've visited a family member here who's been a victim of violence. And one of the things that I was really happy to be able to do is tell them about other types of people that work here. So the types of people that treat you, you know, when you're not a victim of violence and what other careers they might consider, what other reasons you might come to the hospital that might be more positive than to visit a family member who's been a victim of violence.
So what results or improvements in community violence are you seeing as a result of your violence prevention work?
Overall in the city, it's remained about the same, I have to say. There have been peaks and some decreases in some neighborhoods, but I have to say in our neighborhoods it's really been about the same. We haven't really seen, unfortunately, a dip. There, you know, a lot of things happened on a local level after the Freddie Gray incident. In terms of, I think, gang activity increased, mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say. So that spurred a lot of the violence, and or it fueled it, you know, even more. But unfortunately, we haven't seen a decrease. But that caveat saying that if we weren't doing some of this work, who knows what it would be. You know, it might be even far greater than what it is now. So
it's certainly a particularly tricky issue to see impact in a short period of time.
Yes, yeah.
So one of, or a couple of the activities that we spend a fair amount of time on are primary prevention activities. So also difficult to measure. I mean, we measure it by that the young people that we serve in the primary prevention activities hopefully don't down the road become patients in our secondary and tertiary prevention activities. But we have programs for school-age students to come to the hospital and learn about consequences of risk-taking behaviors. And we have programs that go out into the community to encourage good judgment in young people. And in the city, a lot of that includes substance use, but also violence prevention. Two programs, promoting healthy alternatives in teens, and then My Future, My Career.
And I would add also, in terms of outcomes, the recidivism rate for the violence intervention program has been like 0.8%. So that's incredible when you think about the number of individuals that return. Is really, I think it was like one last fiscal year out of all the individuals. So when you really look at that, I mean, you know, regardless of the overall homicide rate and domestic violence rate of the individuals that we've directly been connected to, I think that speaks to, you know, of the power of this program.
And then I have one final question that I always like to leave on. So for other hospitals who either are working on violence prevention or who are considering working on violence prevention, what have you learned, or what words of wisdom do you have that you'd like to impart?
I guess we've hired a couple new people lately who've asked me that same question. So on sort of the direct care level, what I tell them is that you have to be genuine. There's no way to do this work without being genuine, because the patients expect it and deserve it and ultimately know if you're not being genuine. So it has to be a commitment, and we are lucky because we have the commitment all the way through our leadership. So we have strong people standing behind us, and we can stand up to our patients and clients and say we really believe in the mission and it's the work that we're here to do. We're not an offshoot of some other committee or department. Like, we were founded and incepted for this purpose. And that is the first step in convincing patients to trust us, because a lot of them question why anybody would want to help them. And so to have a genuine reason to want to improve the community and to be able to impart that onto the patients is the first step in even getting patients to believe that if they come down, that you're going to be able to help them.
Yeah, and I would just add, too, that, you know, in terms of lesson learned, that even if a hospital is considering doing this and they're not sure, but they see that it's a need in their community, to not be scared to just try it. You know, look at other evidence-based programs that are out there. You know, we would be open to, you know, I think entertain, you know, questions or field questions or requests for information. And don't be afraid to actually try to tackle this. It is a big issue, but if you can hopefully kind of chunk it out into some different aspects of these programs and of the and tackling the problem, that's a little bit easier, but I would say don't shy away from it. It's important and it has to be addressed.
Ann Williams and Aaron Walton, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about your violence prevention work.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.